Today is Monday, June 17th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and coming up, tensions between the United States and Iran continue to rise.
Carrie Lam is effectively dead politically because of this, but she has to wait to resign, basically to save face and for Beijing.
Also ahead, we hear the latest on the protests in Hong Kong. It's all on today's International Edition. This news just in, Egypt's former president Mohamed Morsi has collapsed and died while in a court hearing today in Cairo. The 67-year-old Morsi became Egypt's first democratically elected president in 2012, several months after the Arab Spring protest ousted former president Hosni Mubarak. The military, however, overthrew Morsi following massive protests in 2013. He was arrested on espionage and other charges and has been jailed since then. Well, the spokesman for Iran's Atomic Energy Agency, Behrouz Kamavandi, said today that Tehran would break through the 300-kilogram limit of low-level enriched uranium set by the 2015 nuclear accord within the next 10 days. This would be Iran's first concrete step in breaking with that agreement, Edward Uranian reports for VOA from Cairo.
Iranian state TV broadcast the live news conference by the country's Atomic Energy Agency spokesman from the symbolic Arak heavy water reactor facility, announcing Tehran's decision to break out of the limits set by the 2015 nuclear accord with the P5+1 countries. Spokesman Behrouz Kamavandi told journalists that Iran has quadrupled low-level uranium production in recent days and will go beyond the 300-kilogram limit set by the 2015 accord on June 27. He said Iran would increase production of more heavily enriched uranium as well. He says Iran's needs for other nuclear products has increased as well, and Tehran will produce up to 130 tons of heavy water during the next 2.5 months. But Kamavandi did not completely rule out a return to the limits of the 2015 nuclear accord if the European countries that signed it, France, Britain, and Germany, agree not to apply U.S. economic sanctions imposed in November of 2018. Former Iranian President Abulhassan Bani Sadr tells VOA he thinks Iran's supreme leader Ayatollah Khamenei has found himself in a jam. He says the Iranian Atomic Energy Agency is trying to show the public it is doing something in the face of pressure by the Trump administration, but Tehran really does not have a lot of options. He says he doubts Iran can really scrap the 2015 nuclear accord because it will find itself even more isolated on the international stage and may incur further UN Security Council sanctions. Iranian analyst Ali Nourizadi told Saudi-owned Al Arabiya TV Iranian President Hassan Rouhani reportedly promised Russian President Vladimir Putin at a summit in Kyrgyzstan several days ago that Iran would continue to respect the 2015 nuclear accord. VOA could not independently confirm the claim. Iran's declaration it would exceed the enriched uranium level specified by the 2015 accord comes at the same time tensions in the Gulf have increased following attacks on two oil tankers in the Gulf of Oman, which Washington accuses Iran of perpetrating. Several Iranian officials, including Parliament Speaker Ali Larijani, have denied responsibility for the attacks. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
Thank you, Edward. Well, over the past several weeks, tensions between Iran and the United States have risen sharply. Last week, Washington blamed Iran for apparent attacks on oil tankers in the Persian Gulf. Iran has denied being involved, but in the past, it used mines against ships in the Strait of Hormuz. Carla Babb is VOA's Pentagon correspondent. She's on the line now to update us on the latest in the situation. Hello, Carla.
Hello. Yes, defense officials are definitely doubling down on their calls that Iran is responsible for these attacks. You're hearing this first on the Voice of America. I'm learning that we are just minutes away from the Department of Defense releasing some additional images of the attack on these two tankers. I've been told that you're going to be able to see in greater detail who exactly was on those boats. The boat is supposed to clearly be seen as an Iranian fast attack craft. There are at least 9 people on board wearing some sort of greenish-gray uniform. They say that you can see the actual area where the hull was. Where the mine was attached to the hull. There are close-ups of this. And according to the official that I spoke with, it looks as if the mine actually did detonate but didn't explode. And so the defense official asked me, he goes, now why would the Iranians try to take off something that had partially exploded unless they were trying to remove evidence?
Very interesting. So what were U.S. officials saying over this weekend about this?
So there have been a lot of different things being said. You can see the latest National Security Council spokesman said that in relations to the Iran nuclear deal, Iran's enrichment plans are only possible, he said, because of the horrible deal. So he was kind of slamming the U.S. allies that signed this deal. And he said that President Trump has made it clear that he will never allow Iran to develop nuclear weapons. That is one side of the U.S. response. But then on the other side, you see Acting Secretary of Defense Pat Shanahan and Secretary of State Mike Pompeo calling for an international consensus. Secretary Shanahan said that we have an international situation in the Middle East. It's not just a U.S. situation. He pointed out that the tankers that were attacked were a Japanese-owned tanker and a Norwegian-owned tanker, and they are hoping to get more allies involved so that the United States will not be protecting this strait by itself.
So it does show that, you know, some efforts are being made on the U.S. part to really step back on the dispute somewhat. But what about Iran? What are they doing?
Well, Iran has said that it is willing not to breach their nuclear deal if others who sign the deal will help them circumvent U.S. sanctions. It's unclear how the others are going to react to this because we are hearing split views. You've heard Britain, for example, has appeared to side with the United States, saying that, yes, it is clear that Iran did carry out these actions over the past few weeks when it comes with attacking tankers or attacking a Saudi oil pipeline. On the other hand, you have seen critics say that the United States started this in the first place because the United States was the one that enforced additional sanctions and called the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps of Iran a terrorist organization. So we're just going to have to wait and see how this plays out.
Okay, great. These are day-by-day developments. Anything in the near future?
Well, again, as soon as we get these images, go to Voice of America's website because we will try to put these online for everybody to view themselves.
Great. Thank you so much. That's VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb. Among the top stories in the world, Haiti's anti-corruption protests refuse to back down. The U.S. has reopened a permanent U.S. aid office in Somalia. Officials in Argentina and Uruguay hunt for the cause of the massive power outage in those countries. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the voanews.com website and on our VOA mobile app. This is VOA's International Edition. Xi Jinping will become the first Chinese president to visit North Korea in 14 years when he arrives there on Thursday. China's state broadcaster reported today that Xi will head to Pyongyang to meet with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un Thursday and Friday. Kim has made several trips to Beijing in the past 2 years. China is North Korea's only significant ally. The visit comes as talks between the United States and North Korea on ending Pyongyang's nuclear weapons program have stalled. The timing of the visit may trouble U.S. officials because U.S. President Donald Trump is expected to meet with Xi next week at the G20 summit in Japan. They are expected to discuss trade tensions between the two countries. In Hong Kong today, a smaller group of protesters continue to call for the government to abandon plans for a new extradition law. Yesterday, a massive crowd blocked major roads in the city center in another day of protest. Hong Kong democracy activist Joshua Wong, who was released from prison today, joined those calling for the resignation of the city's pro-Beijing leader, Carrie Lam. The government has suspended action on the legislation, but not canceled it. Protesters fear it would allow Hong Kong's government to extradite people to face trial in mainland China, which they say lacks fair, independent courts. Journalist Aaron Hale is in Hong Kong and has been covering the protest over the past several days. She spoke with my colleague Kate Pound-Dawson about the latest developments.
Today, there were several thousand protesters on the streets, kind of on and off around LegCo. They did manage to close off a few smaller streets. It stayed fairly small compared to yesterday. I think a lot of people are just very tired and regrouping, and it's been a long week. So the protesters who were out today were kind of more, I guess, the younger people who are a little bit more hardcore compared to yesterday, where yesterday it was like just a lot of normal people and families. So these are like the student activists, I think, who are mostly out today.
Joshua Wong, who had led the umbrella movement a few years ago, was just released from prison today. Does he have a role in these protests?
He hasn't yet, but I think his release has really recharged people. You know, he is possibly the most visible activist in Hong Kong, at least internationally. And, you know, he's very widely respected. So his timing was very good. And I think, you know, as I said, a lot of people are probably tired. They've really been pushing quite hard for a week now. Yeah, he's just kind of brought new energy and I think new optimism. And he's vowed to keep protesting until Carrie Lam resigns and the bill is withdrawn. So now, that's a big win for them.
Yeah, good to have them in there. Now, what's expected in the coming days?
Tomorrow there's supposed to be an executive council meeting. So that would be in Carrie Lam's office. And I think after that, there are some reports that an announcement could be made. Perhaps they will announce that the bill has been withdrawn. A lot of more analyst-type people I spoke to today said that Carrie Lam is effectively dead politically because of this. But she has to wait to resign, basically to save face and for Beijing, because there's no really clear successor for her at this point, so they have to wait to find someone. And also, you know, Beijing can't be seen to be acquiescing to large protesters, because that would probably be a political disaster for them. So perhaps they'll give the protesters a little bit of what they want, which is to fully withdraw the bill. But as for Lam to go, she's probably going to wait about 6 or 7 months.
That was Aaron Hale reporting from Hong Kong. She spoke with VOA's Kate Pound-Dawson. Well, a new report by SIPRI, the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute, finds conflict and climate change are largely responsible for rising global hunger. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
More than 800 million people around the world are going hungry. SIPRI reports 60% are in conflict-affected countries. It says political instability and conflict-related displacement generate food crises. The Stockholm Research Institute says food is often inaccessible to people caught in conflict. It says limited supplies of these commodities cause prices to spiral, making food largely unaffordable. Climate change, it says, is worsening the ability of people to get enough to eat. It says hunger is growing as crops and livelihoods in impoverished countries are wiped out by extreme flooding and drought. The UN's World Food Program reports Yemen suffered the worst food crisis last year, followed in order of severity by DR Congo, Afghanistan, Ethiopia, Syria, Sudan, South Sudan, and northern Nigeria. WFP spokesman Hervé Verhoosel says these eight countries account for two-thirds of all people facing acute hunger.
Even in conflict-affected areas with limited access, such as South Sudan and Yemen, when we can do our job safely and have consistent access to people in need, we can prevent the worst form of hunger. We only see famine now when our staff are not able to reach the food insecure people due to insecurity or where our access is blocked.
Verhoosel says more than 113 million people in 53 countries suffer from acute hunger and are in urgent need of food, nutrition, and livelihood assistance. He notes conflict and insecurity are the main drivers of hunger in 21 of these countries. WFP is the world's largest humanitarian agency fighting hunger. Each year, it provides food assistance to nearly 90 million people in areas affected by conflict and natural disasters. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
This is VOA's International Edition.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, and on my program Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and the Voice of America.
On Our Voices, we're talking about the news and issues you're talking about,
sharing stories of development and growth across Africa, around the world, and in our lives. Topics that inform, empower,
and change the rules.
It's time for Our Voices with me, Haiti Adams Fitzpatrick,
and Hadiza Kiari,
and Ayan Bior,
and Orion Itangi Shaka.
Join us on Facebook at VOA Our Voices.
It's time for Our Voices.
Security forces in northeastern Nigeria continue to investigate the triple suicide attack that killed at least 30 people last night in the town of Kanduga. Three people detonated suicide bomb vests near a hall where scores of people had gathered to watch a soccer match on television. At least 40 people were injured. No one has taken responsibility for the attack, but the Islamic militant group Boko Haram has conducted scores of such attacks over the past decade in northeastern Nigeria. Well, U.S. auto sales have slowed by about 3% over the past 6 months, stoking fears for the future health of the American and global economies over the middle term. To find out more about the sluggish car sales and their relationship to sales of both durable and retail goods and what to expect overall, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with Joe Song, senior U.S. economist for Bank of America Merrill Lynch.
We are starting to see some softening in auto sales, but you have to remember we are coming off a multi-year high. We've seen really strong demand prior 3 years, so they might be in for, you know, a bigger correction than the overall economy might be. But part of that story is we start to see demand slow, but supply has been ramping up. And that's led to a glut of inventory, which means that they're probably going to have to lower their prices. While all that's happening, you are starting to see a glut of used cars coming onto the market as well.
But why should a glut of used cars be bad for auto manufacturers?
If the choice is buying a pre-owned car, 2-3 years old, for 25% less than a new car, a lot of folks are going to go for the cheaper one. So all that is going to put additional downward pressure on prices, and that's going to put automakers in a tough spot.
So is this softening of the market for new cars a warning sign of a potential slowdown for the U.S. economy overall?
We do track auto sales, but there are other metrics that we take into account, such as job growth and personal income growth, so primarily wage gains. And if you look across those indicators, auto sales are the only thing that's really flashing yellow. Everything else is still holding up. So all those things suggest that consumers still have room to spend. And as long as consumers remain confident that the economy is going to continue to grow, they should keep spending.
Is there any kind of correlation between the auto market and the market for other durable goods, you know, things that you only buy once in a while?
Softening in the auto sector could portend to some softening in other durable goods, such as TVs and refrigerators, but not necessarily, you know, a complete downturn.
And what about the market for non-durable goods, transient things that we need a lot, clothes, restaurants, tourism, that kind of thing?
The consumers still feel like the economy is on a steady track. They're starting to see their income pick up. They still see a really strong labor market. So all those things are leading them to go out and spend.
What would you say might be the relationship between the cooling down of the auto manufacturing sector in the U.S. and the global economy?
So obviously, auto sector is a big component of U.S. manufacturing, and U.S. manufacturing is at the forefront of these trade disputes, right? So since these trade tensions have ratcheted up, we've seen other regions around the world start to falter as well. So autos is definitely feeling some of that pain.
It sounds like the bottom line for you is that you're not overly concerned about the softening of the auto market, but you'll be watching the numbers very closely to see what develops.
I think that's exactly right. Moving forward, what we'll be watching is how these trade negotiations play out. If we start to see a ratcheting up of these tariffs, especially on consumer goods, that could be something that takes the momentum out of consumer spending and moving on.
You're talking mainly about tensions between the U.S. and China?
U.S.-China, definitely. We also have had the ratcheting up of pressure on Mexico. We're clearly not out of the woods just yet. The administration can review the agreement every 90 days, so President Trump could place those tariffs on again. Additionally, there are investigations going on of potentially putting tariffs on foreign autos. That would be a big sticker shock for consumers, and that could be a significant drag on the auto sector as well.
That was auto industry analyst Joe Song, senior U.S. economist for Bank of America Merrill Lynch. He spoke with VOA's Adam Phillips in New York. Well, U.S. President Donald Trump campaigned on cutting the country's trade deficit, particularly with China. Since coming to office in 2017, he has imposed a series of tariffs on China and other countries. But as Matt Small of the Associated Press reports, many American businesses say the tariffs are hurting them.
Amid the trade war, it started with Beijing. The Trump administration asked for comments on its plan to extend 25% tariffs to everything China ships to the United States. And hundreds of businesses, trade groups, and individuals from the U.S. Chamber of Commerce to the Indian Motorcycle Company have responded. They're complaining that additional import taxes would boost prices for consumers, squeeze profits, and leave U.S. companies at a competitive disadvantage to foreign rivals that aren't subject to higher taxes on the vital components they buy from China. Some will appear in person to air their grievances in 7 days of hearings that begin here today. Matt Small, Washington.
Well, in the U.S., the popular pizza delivery chain Domino's is going high-tech with its service using an autonomous vehicle to deliver meals. Ben Thomas with the Associated Press has more.
Domino's is teaming up with a company called Nuro, a Silicon Valley startup that makes unmanned delivery vehicles. The test is expected to begin as early as September at one Domino's location in Houston. Customers will be able to place an order online, track the vehicle's location, and retrieve their pizza from it using a special code. Nuro has experience at this. It's been delivering groceries using autonomous vehicles in Houston and Arizona since late last year in a partnership with Kroger. And Domino's, too, has tested autonomous delivery 2 years ago in a partnership with Ford. But in that case, a safety driver was at the wheel. I'm Ben Thomas.
You've been listening to VOA's International Edition. You can find us at voanews.com. Thanks for joining us, and thanks to our director, Patrice Martin, and our engineer, Peter Hundley. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Nikki Strong. You love music? How about Blake Shelton and Carrie Underwood? Or Merle Haggard and Loretta Lynn? Experience the best in country music on Country Hits USA. I bring you some country rock, outlaw, a little hillbilly, contemporary, and more, with a dash of entertainment news, too. So join me for Country Hits USA on VOA1, the voice of America.